Welcome once again to Food Conversations, Season 2. Food Conversations, a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shuswap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shuswap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Today we have two guests, and we're delighted to have two guests who've been very central to the Food Conversations show and to food issues in the Shuswap in general. We have Serena Kaner, who is the president, and Melanie Bennett, who is the secretary of the Shuswap Food Action Society. Welcome, Serena and Melanie.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Lovely to see you again. And by the way, in case anybody's wondering, we're doing this on Zoom. So Melanie and Serena are sitting in their chilly homes trying to find enough money to pay for the heat, as all of us are doing these days. Winter has come upon us. It's not as cold as it used to be, but it can still get quite chilly. And listeners will probably remember that Melanie is a former wedding planner, which means you have to have exceptional organizational abilities. And Serena is a former dietitian at the Shuswap Lake General Hospital in the Interior Health Authority and has extensive knowledge of food and nutrition. And both of them are passionate advocates for regional food security and food sovereignty here in our part of the world. So we have two guests who can talk a lot about what this show is all about. And perhaps we should start by acknowledging the fact that as of about 2.5 weeks ago, we've had some extraordinary events taking place that have impacted the food system, if you like, quite dramatically. On November the 14th, the first of three successive atmospheric rivers. I love that phrase. You just imagine a giant sluice up in the sky pouring water down on the earth. And that's essentially what happened. It knocked out every major highway in the lower third of the province, and it flooded large areas in the Fraser Valley and basically washed away 350 homes in Merritt, BC, which are still inactivated by this incredible event. Starting with you, Serena, what do you see? You've seen impacts on the food system, and what thoughts have gone through your mind as you've watched this cataclysm taking place?
I think for me, what it's really hit home is, you know, I've always been worried about climate change and the ability to grow food, right? So drought, flooding, you know, it's very hard for agriculture. But what this has shown is that, you know, growing the food is really now such a small part of food getting to your table. So, you know, there's the whole supply chain of distribution, you know, those are things that we also have to be worried about.
And we have been worried about because the panic buying precipitated by this series of events has cleared out store shelves in many parts of this community.
And I think one thing a lot of people aren't aware of is that even though we, you know, we produce milk in this region and we produce eggs in this region, all, you know, to meet health standards, all that, and to get processed, all that raw material has to be shipped down to the coast. So most of our milk is processed in the lower mainland, and most of our eggs are graded in the lower mainland. And so even if they're not allowed to sell raw milk in Canada. So, you know, what's happened is, you know, millions of gallons of milk have been poured down the gutter as a result of this this catastrophe.
Melanie, as somebody with organizational skills built into your DNA, what kind of disruption of our organization of food distribution have you noted, and what is it meant to you as an observer and a participant?
As somebody who really wishes for all of us to take a level of ownership in our own food security, I get a little bit frustrated because we keep getting shown these little glimpses of of what's possible and what could happen. And then we get lulled back into submission when everything seems to go back to normal. And we keep being shown and we keep being shown, and we're not really doing enough. But I am incredibly hopeful that we can. So, you know, these kinds of situations, last year it already happened. The timeline, it's like 2 years ago, is it not almost? Grocery stores started being cleared out because of panic buying due to a pandemic.
Exactly, and, yes.
And then, you know, and it really did spur a lot of action. People started growing more food that spring. People were started canning, but it's still not quite enough. And so now we've been shown it again. And so now what do we do with it? We still saw some panic buying, and it would be great if we can take these lessons and start to be proactive about things.
It's interesting that when something goes, as we would consider it, desperately wrong, it's actually a stimulus for us to start doing a lot better, to actually correct a situation and build in solutions rather than waiting for another disaster to wake us a little bit up a little bit more. Serena, do you sense in your conversations with people that there's a shifting mood, that people are starting to wake up and realize that a 5,000 kilometer food chain is completely unreasonable and inoperable?
Some people are, for sure. Like we are having, you know, in our organization, I feel like there is a growing interest. We noticed at our farmers market, there's been, I think probably the best farmers market of the season was after, you know, the farmers made the most money the week that the highways closed and, you know, the grocery stores were out of produce. So in that sense, there has, but I don't know that the general population has enough knowledge about what goes into the food to get it there, to really be able to grasp what, you know, the extent of the issue.
Melanie, your thoughts on the subject? Do you think people are starting to wake up? Do you sense people starting to wake up?
They definitely are. And so, you know, there are different levels of economic capacity. And, you know, as our organization, we are trying to work with those different levels. Those who have the means to put in a garden, to do some food preservation, to have 3-6 months worth of food, they can do that, and they're doing that. But then there's an entire other multiple levels of demographics that cannot do that. And so this is where we are now. We are not islands unto ourselves, and we are all in this together. And so we need all people working together at this point, being proactive. And if you have the means, we're going to have to start looking at how do we help those without means until they can be self-sustainable.
It's probably at this point that we should start talking about the work that the Shuswap Food Action Society is doing, because it's an organization that's devoted to finding solutions to the kinds of problems that the atmospheric rivers and other...
And fires
and droughts and debris flows in places that don't just affect highways, but affect all sorts of other things. I think it's fair to say that the Shuswap Food Action Society is at the forefront in this community of trying to make sure that we have some kind of food security as a start, and then as time goes by, food sovereignty, where we have control over the food supply, not just have it in our hands. And so let's start talking about some of the things that the SFAS has been doing over the last while, ongoing programs and some new initiatives as well. So, Melanie, let's start talking about the coldest night of the year. We've had one episode in which the Food Action Society played a central role. Let's start there. How did this year's event get rolling, and just give a little bit of background of how it happened?
Well, great segue. We are very excited to be hosting once again the coldest night of the year for Salmon Arm and the Shoe Swap coming up Saturday, February 26th. This year, it came back to us again because it was an amazingly successful campaign last year. We had a lot of support. Actually, is a kind of surprising show of support for being such a still underknown society. But, you know, because of what had happened and store shelves and people's feelings of vulnerability and the recognition of vulnerability, I think people really recognize that, yeah, food security is really important.
So why don't you outline what happened, the first time around? How, a little bit about the process, because people, not everybody knows how hard you worked to make that happen. It didn't just spring out of the ground.
Well, it was like a gift given to us. And we decided we must take this opportunity because we had three objectives. One was in order to receive some funding for our organization so that we can do these amazing projects. But also, we really needed to take the opportunity to raise awareness about food insecurity. So we had sort of a campaign downtown where we were putting statistics and solutions in the business windows. And then using social media, of course, to really tell the stories. And then the third one was, of course, just to raise awareness about our organization so that we can have more people want to join with us.
Was it a little bit scary to get started on this process?
Well, doing anything unknown is always scary. Like, that's what we're all facing right now. Anything unknown is uncomfortable. But you get started. You take one step at a time, you do the next task, and then the beautiful thing, too, is that more and more people get involved, they lend their voice, and collaboration begins, and then it gets easier.
There's resonance in the community.
Yeah. And then there's energy that's driven by that, too. There was a lot of energy and momentum that began, you know, come January when we really started talking about it, more and more teams joined, more people were talking about it, and this gave people an opportunity too, being that last year was a virtual walk, which meant people could walk anywhere, anytime during February. People just got together and they were walking. And that was so healthy for everyone because they were feeling a little isolated. They were unsure of what was happening and if they were safe. So they were getting out and walking, and what's, you know, not much healthier than that, right?
So how much support, both financial and otherwise, came in to the Food Action Society as a result of that first iteration of the coldest night of year in your hands?
We had a goal of raising $40,000, and we exceeded that, skyrocketed past it, and raised $62,000.
That must have really told you that you'd done it right.
You know, honestly, for those of us who have been really passionate in doing this, Serena and myself and other board members who've been putting in a lot of time and energy into this society, it helped so much just to make us feel like, yes, keep going. There is support. People do want this. Keep going.
Serena, do you want to comment here just what it was like for you as well, like Melanie, to see the community really rallying around? What was that like?
Yeah, you know, it's especially nice when, like, for example, our farmers market, all the vendors made a team, and they were like, not only did they make a team, but they like got together and they organized gift baskets to auction off, and like, so it was really like a snowball effect. Where, I mean, I think Melanie is being modest, but she is the real reason for success. I can't take any credit for the coldest night.
No, you don't have to take credit.
I'm not the wedding planner. I'm like the anti. I'm like the call you half an hour before my wedding starts, and you're like, oh, by the way,
I'm getting married. It's your wedding day.
Was it you I was going to get married to, or was it? Yeah, I think it was you. Yeah.
Yeah, I think let's get married. Okay, sure. So I wouldn't have been able to orchestrate such a successful event. However, I have been working hard at, you know, the ideas behind our organization.
Well, we're going to get to some of those ideas in a moment. So we're going to talk some more about the coldest night of the year, and especially next year's planning. But I want to move on to another initiative that has been very close to your heart, Serena, and that is the school kitchen at Jackson. And that's been that's been something you've put your heart and soul into. Why don't you talk a little bit about that initiative and how it's gone this year and its, you know, its strengths and challenges. Why don't you share that with us?
Sure. Well, I mean, I've obviously been interested in school food a long time because I'm a parent and a dietitian. And so I, you know, at the heart, I believe that children need access to healthy food. But I when COVID hit, the high school closed down. So students weren't allowed to leave campus. And this high school had no cafeteria program or they had no meal program. So, you know, kids were ordering pizzas to school and you know, all they had inside were like chocolate bars and pop. And so I was sort of like, we need to do something here. And so I applied for a grant with the Community Foundation. And we started just a once a week soup program. And it was free. And I had some volunteers and every Friday we would go in and make soup and we had buns and fruit and kids could have it if they wanted it. And we were shocked by the number of kids who showed up every day. So
the uptake was initially
huge,
quite
strong. Yeah. So we had like 200 kids every day. And like we weren't making like, it wasn't like I was offering French fries and hamburgers. Like this was like lentil soup and chicken noodle. And, you know, they were very like simple meals. So that kind of gave me the idea that, yeah, we do need to be offering these kids real food and they will eat it. So the following year, we talked with the principal and of course, their kitchen wasn't really appropriate for cooking to scale. So we got another grant and also from the Community Foundation and bought some equipment to make so that we could make a few because kids don't want to eat soup every day. We started. So we're doing a meal program 4 days a week there. And then the leadership sells pizza on the other day. So that's been the beginning. And of course, it's been a huge learning curve because this year students are allowed to leave the school campus. So the difference is that we're now competing with like Tim Hortons and the corner store and Freedom.
Yes, and Freedom. Yes, as much as that, perhaps that's as much as the reason for people heading out of the school grounds. But what's the response you're getting? What are you hearing from students? You know, when they come, you're serving what, about 50 or so students on a regular basis?
Yeah, right now we're about 50 a day. And so the other difference from last year is they have to pay for it. So last year it was free. And of course, we can't always, you know, it isn't free to operate. So food's not free. So the other, you know, the other change is that now that students are paying for it, but we're getting really good feedback. And we're actually connected with the leadership class. And so they're helping us serve the food. So, you know, kids are getting some food literacy. And I think, you know, what they've done studies on school meal programs and the benefit to making school in-house is that, you know, the students smell all the cooking and, you know, it fills the school. And the other thing is that, you know, it makes students feel cared for. So, you know, I think knowing that you can get food at school is, and as a parent too, is very comforting, right?
Sure. So it's
can I use an opportunity just to make sure that we plug in this marketing here?
Marketing.
So that people can know how they can get involved. You know, we really do want to make sure that this program is sustainable. And that's why, you know, being able to charge a small fee, realistically, when you think about what whatever the child is buying out of the school, this is really affordable for good food. We're also keeping money in our local food economy because we're buying as many local ingredients as possible. So we do need, you know, buy-in from parents, but also the community at large could buy punch passes for these meals, and they could actually provide it to the faculty. And the faculty could give some of these punch cards to children that they know could really benefit from this program.
And that has happened. So we've had people in the community donate money. And then we buy the, because every punch cards, you can buy them or we can give them away. So we, you know, there are punch cards that are given to students who if the school knows that they are at risk. And I think the issue with food insecurity is you never know, right? And especially in school, like kids feel a lot of shame. They don't want to say anything.
They don't
advertise. So we are missing some people. But like Melanie said, it's Like if you bring your own bowl, it's $4, and you can't really buy meals in out in anywhere for $4. We're actually, I think, cheaper than Tim Hortons. So, and so
sorry, Tim, you're good, but you're not that good.
So I just that, you know, we are really trying to make this an affordable, but at the same time, you know, food does cost money, and it costs money to make the food. So it's hard to be free for everybody.
So what kind of response have you got from the school itself, the administration, the school district? What kind of reaction are you generating there?
I think it's been really positive. Because obviously it reflects, you know, parents are happy about it. So if parents are happier, then usually the administrators are happy. And if it makes the school look better, then, you know, the district is happy. So I think, I haven't like personally talked to everybody on the district level. My feeling is that it's positive.
And about half, if I understand correctly, about half the food you put into the meals comes from local sources. Is that about right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the benefits we have is we run the farmers market, right? And so I already have a direct relationship with a lot of the food growers in our area. And I have to be at the farmers market every weekend anyway. So it's not a big, you know, I usually just buy the food for the week on the weekend. And then I bring it into school and it just sits in the fridge. So, as January, February, it gets a bit more challenging. And part of the issue is that kids have become so used to eating everything and anything that a lot of kids have not adapted the taste for foods that grow well locally.
And also lentils versus chocolate bars. It's
a tough sell. And the thing is with this system, when you have to pay for it, like I would love for it to be free, because then kids will try anything for free. But once you're to pay money for something that you're not sure you're going to like, people just won't do it. That's the problem.
What about parents? Are you hearing any feedback from parents? Serena, Melanie, either of you?
The parents who I get feedback from, I think, are all the ones that like, I think there's some parents probably that still don't know that we exist, but there are some parents who are like, you've saved my life. I hate making my child's lunch. and just taking that burden off. And knowing that your kid's going to get a healthy meal at school, I think is a really big bonus.
Yeah. With, you know, I have two children in school, so does Serena, and cold lunches, it doesn't feel fulfilling, it doesn't feel sustaining, and, you know, I would love to be able to have the ability to buy a hot lunch for my kids every day at school.
It's a win-win situation, obviously. Children get good quality food, but also tasty, good quality food. And local food growers have their produce enjoyed by the citizens that live just down the road from them. It's something that when an atmospheric river is afoot, we obviously can see a triple benefit. It means that there's no interruption in the availability of food for children, which has got to be a basic requirement of any society, that your children don't have to go hungry.
Well, and I think one thing that's overlooked is the benefit of peer pressure. Like Mel and I, our kids go to the same school, and so I've been running, or like our pack has been running, a hot lunch program since my kids started there, where we cook food with the students for the entire school. And one of my daughters is I don't want to call her a picky eater, but she's very choosy on, like, she has sensitive taste buds, let's say.
Sensitive taste buds. I love that. We'll take that.
Drives me insane. And I struggle to feed her at home. But at school, she will eat things that I know if I made them at home, it would be, you know, tears and crying. But it's like as soon as your friends are eating it and they're liking it, like we'll make lentil soup, and the kids are like, can I have a second bowl?
Let's call this like food psychotherapy.
And there's no parents to be there to, you know, be like, you have to eat this. So you're taking out that whole power dynamic, and kids are just, they're curious. They want to be like their friends, and they'll eat it.
Melody, what do your kids say about the food at school?
Every time they've ever had it, of course, they love it. So that's always a benefit. My kids do not really have sensitive palates. So I've been a pretty firm,
they're omnivorous,
stern mother. One thing I just want to say, though, too, is, you know, Serena, like she had said, she, you know, she's a big idea person. You know, one reason to support the Shoe Shop Food Action Society is, you know, this is one project that's, you know, taken hold. But there's about, you know, 10 other projects brewing in her mind. And a lot, and one of them is, you know, a universal school meal program, which we don't have in Canada. You know, another one is creating a PAC, so Parental Advisory Committee, lunch toolkit. You know, school gardens. Serena is also now a liaison for the farm to school program. So there are so many ideas brewing that we would love to implement, and we just need
$1 million. $1 million would help.
And funds.
Well, all of these ideas are brewing in society as a whole as well. And I think that means that when, like with the coldest night of the year, when you start out the project, people start to respond, they want to participate, and the next thing you know, they're starting to add their own value-added contribution to what you're doing. And there's no question that people around the nation are aware of the fact that if children eat well, especially a meal while they're in the middle of the educational environment, it softens the blow of the educational environment. It makes it more homey. It makes it more welcoming. And for every reason you can think of, it's a pretty good thing to do. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about the school food program as we go along, but I'd like to bring up another of the initiatives that's been central to the Food Action Society, and that is the Community Teaching Garden, which Melanie has played a central role in. Melanie, why don't you just describe what the Teaching Garden is all about, and then a little bit about what's happened this year.
So I'm just going to make sure I give the proper accolades. This project was initiated by the Shoe Shop Family Center, Patty Thurston and Emily Vardell, who actually moved away to Vancouver, unfortunately. But, you know, they got it going. The Food Action Society, we lent our energy as well. And in the last few years, in order to keep it going and make it sustainable, our organization has taken a lead on it. And so what my sort of role has been in the last couple of years, is just telling the story, getting people up there, getting volunteers, finding some funding and sponsorship, and helping it to grow lots of food.
And posting a lot of tremendously colorful, beautiful photographs on social media and by email. I've received a number of these mailings, and I almost want to leap out and run up to the garden and start digging in the soil.
And lots of long-winded videos. It's really rewarding. It's a really beautiful space. The lady who owned the land originally, Leslie Gurney, she lived here, and she wanted that space to be a garden where anyone could come. They could walk off that road and come into the garden and help themselves to food. And then, you know, the family center wanted to take some of that food into their kitchens and help their clients to learn how to grow food, cook food, eat well. In the last few years, I mean, since especially with COVID, you know, volunteers, it was hit or miss. A lot of our energies just went into making sure we were producing food to give to the Second Harvest Food Bank. So we didn't, you know, a lot of community kitchens were closed down, so that wasn't a part of it. We were just offering a beautiful space for people to come, give some of their time and energy in a safe way to help us grow food, to give to those who needed it.
So how did COVID had an impact? The climate is having an impact in many ways. How did these external factors impinge upon what was going on in the garden?
Last year, initially, people were really unsure about coming out. So volunteerism has really had taken a hit. It already was, because volunteers are aging out, is sort of the term. That the notion of giving back to your community isn't something that we've been doing in the last couple of generations. It's not a part of our daily life. We're so busy you know, two income families, kids, sport, like everybody's just so busy that giving back is just not a part of the timeline. And yet it is so necessary and needed. Volunteers was a challenge for that first year. This year, of course, the biggest issue was the heat, the drought, and then the fires.
What kind of impact did these events, I mean, it had an impact on everything that was growing in this community. What kind of impact did it have on the garden, and what was viable in the garden? I mean, we had raspberries that got baked on the vine. They came on later, but after the heat dome, they were pretty sad.
Last year was good. You do as much as you can without a lot of hands. You know, many hands make light work, and without a lot of hands, you just don't stay on top of the garden as well as you can. And so that was that for last year, for 2020. For this past season, we had hands, but watering was an issue. Obviously, the heat, keeping up to watering was a big issue. The garden is so well cared for that weeding wasn't much of an issue, in fact. But, you know, things weren't growing as well as they could. Seeds weren't germinating as well as they could. We were having to do a lot of replanting. And because we don't have someone there all the time, it just means that if it doesn't get watered, it doesn't sprout, and there you go. And so we did as best we could. We grew over 1,400 pounds of beautifully, naturally grown produce, and we logged in about 600 volunteer hours.
600? I understand it was even bigger than that, but hey.
It was over. I mean, we are trying to quantify.
That's an underestimate. Right.
Yeah, we're trying to quantify, so we have a sign-in book, and people can sign in and out. They also just can record whatever, if they did take any food. But on our Harvest Tuesdays, when we would have people come up, we would tally up the pounds of the different kinds of produce. And this is just so that we can have numbers if we were to apply for grants and things like that.
What kind of age range did you have coming out to the garden? I know on a couple of visits I've made, there's a cadre of youngsters who are supplying, if nothing else, a lot of energy. What kind of people, you know, age and background, that kind
all
of
thing? All ages.
Yeah.
All ages. Kids, 30s, 40s, 60s, 80, Darlene. So, I want to take an opportunity to say thank you so much to Nan, who is a board member of ours, but she was also, she was there probably more than anybody, making sure things got watered. So, it's all ranges. We really encourage that. It's a family-friendly place. We encourage children. We have a little sandbox area with some toys. Although the kids usually would get themselves involved. They love digging potatoes. We would offer them the potato beetle safari to go in pest management. Most of the time, they always ended up on the big wood chip pile. So it was really good. Their energy is good and positive. And it's so important to be having kids get their hands in the dirt, learn what their food looks like, where it actually comes from, and eat a carrot right out of the ground.
Indeed, indeed. One of the great pleasures of childhood is to go out in the garden and pick something right off a vine or right out of the ground and wipe it off very rudimentarily and then ingest it right there on the spot. This is food grown by local citizens for the experience of growing, but there are people who are growing food as a livelihood. And maybe it's time to talk a little bit, Serena, about the farmers market, which is a place where people who grow food and try to make a living out of it come to sell their wares, and where people come to buy food from fresh local food sources. The farmers market now, we'll talk about how the Food Action Society has become so central in the farmers market, because it wasn't always that way, but now it really does appear to be that way.
Yeah, well, I was approached a few years ago and by the Downtown Salmon Farm Association, and they're like, oh, we heard you wanted to start a farmers market. I was like, well, I don't think that's quite, I mean, I wanted there to be a farmers market. But I wasn't sure that I was the one that wanted to start it. However, I took on that challenge. And, you know, with lots of people's help. You know, at that time, Lindsay Wong was the manager, and I definitely would not have been able to do it without Lindsay. It's been growing over the last 3 years, and you know, it's been hard. We've had COVID, and last year we had smoke. Like, it was gross out for, you know, 6 weeks of the summer. But we have had really loyal support from our community. And despite it being like smoky and hot, you know, people were showing up, they were buying the produce. And, you know, as a result, our a lot of our farmers experienced their best year this year, despite COVID and the heat dome.
And so, probably had a huge uptake when the roads disappeared.
Yes, that was a huge market. But I think, you know, I think people, what people like is that when you start moving away from, you know, the industrial food system and going to sort of what we call relational eating. That's how we, our board member calls it, relational eating. And it's like, when you know who's grown your food and, you know, you have a relationship with that person, a lot of people come to the market and they look forward to it every week because they get, you know, those farmers are their friends. And, you know, that's mental health right there. As you go there, you're smiling the whole time. You're running into people you know. And especially in the COVID times when you know, a lot of people don't ever run into people they know anymore because they never leave their house.
And it's outdoors.
Outdoors. It's totally safe. So, you know, I think the farmers market has become a really important community hub. And it's somewhere that people can rely on to see people that they know. To have access to food, and of course we run the nutrition coupon program. You know, so there are these subsidized dollars that give access to people who may not otherwise be able to afford it, and you get all sorts of people at farmers markets. You know, my favorite places are farmers markets and dog parks because they're like the two things that just attract a really wide variety of people that wouldn't normally interact with each other outside of that. You know, and so you get tourists, you know, you just get everybody. And I think it's sort of the event that people look forward to now.
There's something powerful about bringing people together around food. In this case, they're purchasing it as opposed to cooking it. But some of the food is already prepared, so they can purchase, you know, breads and other already created things. But there is a kind of joyous atmosphere. I've been there a number of times over the years, and there's always a sense of celebration. Everybody's there to have a good time. It's not like going to pay your taxes or where you commiserate with one another. When you go to the market, you really are looking to have a pleasant encounter with the people who are vendors and also the people who are there. Now, just briefly, you mentioned Howie, but you made a comment before we came on the air. Howie saved my life. Why don't you tell something about Howie so the world can know.
Well, Howie's our new board member who's like, he's about we're both really big thinkers, but he's very introverted and he's very in the background and he's very detail oriented. And so, you know, running an event like a farmer's market, there's so many details involved and when you're also a mother with children and another job,
you have some other details to pay attention to.
There's other details that are floating around my mind besides the farmer's market, and he's really taken on all those details that needed to be taken on that I wasn't always paying attention to, which just makes me feel like a big sigh of relief, like a big load has been taken off my shoulder. So I'm very grateful.
I think it's a wonderful thing that you have a competent, intelligent, articulate, big ideas woman has a fellow who's running around to do the management process. This is the kind of role
traditional role reversal.
Absolutely,
the woman is taking over and the man is doing the details.
We need more of this everywhere, I think.
While we're talking about Howie, can we just mention membership?
Absolutely, this is
okay.
We're full of segues in every direction.
Perfect. And so, thank you to Howie, who reinitiated our membership. So we sort of let it lapse for a while. We weren't really sure how we wanted to handle it, accounting and all those kinds of things. And he's taking care of all of those details. And so we do have membership back up on our website, shushuapfood.ca. And we've created a different way of handling it, though, too. So we have our annual memberships at $20 a year for those who just, you know, want to support us. But then we also have a couple of different levels. So we have a friend of the society for $100 a year. And we have actually set up online banking so people can do a payment per month to make it a little bit smaller increments. And then we also have Food Action Champions. So these are folks who really believe that food security is important. They appreciate what we're doing, and they really want to support our organization. And so, this, of course, this could be individuals, but it can also be businesses who would like to become Food Action Champions at for $500 a year. So this is, we are a community-funded organization at this point because we, you know, grants are challenging. We try and find as many grants for our projects as possible. But in order for us to keep full steam ahead, we want the support of our community. And one of the ways that we're doing that is through membership.
There has to be, for the universe, a better way for nonprofit organizations to maintain membership than having to fire out a request for membership each year. All the organizations I've ever belonged to have found that at some point, if you get people to have an automatic, you know, repeat membership, you know, if you don't tell us you don't want to be a member, then we'll take your $20 every year, because it is such an onerous task. So Howie, if you're listening to this show and your ears are burning, you realize how much of an addition you have made to this, yes, this organization that's really trying to change things, and your role has been a significant one. Just a couple of comments, but I think we should, in a moment, we'll go on to talk about the food forest, because that's a new initiative that's really quite a conceptual break, but also a powerful stimulus for change in the way food is perceived and grown in this community. Food forest. The terms are not always put together, but they do have a special relationship. Melanie, why don't you talk about how the food forest in Salmon Arm was shepherded into existence, and who's involved with it?
This came about, so thankfully you did a really great interview with Joel of the Salvation Army and Kelly Westgate of Leckerland Design. So people could listen in for more details. Go to the podcast portion of Voice of the Shuswap and you can listen in for more details about the food forest. But basically, this comes about because we need to see better use of our public grass spaces, our green spaces. And so Joel, he was having conversations with Serena. He was being really inspired about the food insecurity and making solutions. He and I had a conversation. I was trying to learn more about the homeless population as I was learning for Coldest Night of the Year. And it's always about timing. Mm-hmm. It's about meeting the right people who have the right passion and energy for something. Mm-hmm. And that's how the spark starts. And he wanted to see a better use of that just empty green space around the shelter. His vision is that, you know, people, the shelter is not always open for, or I should say the food bank is not always open for people. So what about the rest of the time when they're hungry? And so, you know, a better use of a green space, whether it's a community garden or in this case, the food forest came about through, you know, bringing Kelly and Joel together. And she, as a permaculture designer, we're looking to create sustainable solutions. We have to be proactive, and using these permaculture techniques is all about, you know, being resilient to drought, stacking functions, which means benefiting the whole through all of the different components that go into it. So we hope that this food forest will become a really wonderful showcase on what people can do for themselves, take home these ideas and start transforming their own yards into beautiful food forests.
That's a wonderful notion, and I think it's something that has universal appeal, that instead of just having something that's nice to look at, you can actually walk into the space and pick something off a tree or pull something up out of the ground and eat it. As Joel said in our show about the food forest with Kelly and him, When the food bank shuts at 6 o'clock and you're hungry, what do you do? Well, you wander over to the food forest and you grab something off a tree. In other words, it's increasing accessibility to food, not just geographically, but also in temporal terms, in time terms. You can find food just by wandering around and looking somewhere where you know food is available, which I think is a very powerful thing in terms of sort of future stabilization and integration of the food supply in this part of the world. And maybe we can talk a little bit about future plans in that regard. We talked about membership, of course, increasing membership. You're going to also be having, of course, this year, and you might want to reiterate the dates, the Coldest Night of the Year celebration event.
February the 26th,
and you're inviting teams and you're inviting everybody who wants to participate in any particular way to be part of it?
Yes. You know, the food forest and even with Coldest Night of the Year, Serena said something in a conversation, and you'll kind of always forget. Today is actually International Human Rights Day.
It is indeed.
And food is a human right. And if you look it up, you know, it's about availability, accessibility, having adequate access, and sustainable. And so, you know, food being a human right, providing these opportunities for people to be able to go and use land and eat when they need to is a really, you know, big part of what we'll be promoting through the Coldest Night of the Year. That we all have, our mission is that we believe everyone should have the right to an affordable and accessible local diet. And so for the Coldest Night of the Year, we invite folks to, you go on to cnoy.org and you find our location to be able to find more event details, to sign up as a walker, or you can sign up as a team captain and you can create a team. And this will be for Saturday, February 26th, where we will be having an in-person walk this year. Last year was virtual. This year we are being encouraged, and we encourage everyone to walk together as a community. We will be using our downtown location again as our route, which we're still working on.
In the parking lot of Saskatoon?
We're going to serve a meal this year. We're going to make a beautiful soup, because Serena is excellent at making vast quantities of soup now. And we will serve a really nice hot soup after everybody's had their cold walk.
And it will be at Saskatoon again, the parking lot? Is that worked out
yet?
We are
ironing out details, but most likely our starting place will be Saskatoon, and our ending place, though, will be at the beautiful Treble Clef, you know? Little city, big ideas, Treble Clef.
I think ironing out is the first non-food metaphor we've actually had on the show today. It's all about growing and, anyway, seeding. Let's move on to some other issues. About the notion of expanding food accessibility, one way to do it, of course, is for people to be growing food in their own space. And the Green Thumb Project, just who would like to say something about the Green Thumb Project? We can have an idea, Serena, or we can have the organizational side from Melanie, or we can have both.
The Green Thumb Project, I think, actually was back when Jen Gamble was involved with the Shuswap Food Action, and they got a grant, and one of our board members, Laureen Shannon. And so they built garden beds at people's homes or at an organization's home. I think there's one outside of the old DAC. And so they built these garden beds that people could then plant and grow food in their own yard. And so that, I know, is an idea that Melanie is very passionate about. We, you know, we do hope to do it again.
Melanie, passion. Your chance to speak up.
I just want people to recognize that we have to come up with new solutions. We can't keep doing the same things over and over again. And this is our opportunity now. We are being shown that we need to try something new. And the nice thing is that we don't have to do anything new, because we just have to look to the past. People used to grow a garden. They grew more of their own food. They learned how to preserve it. They stocked their larder. And we can go back to all of those things. And they are so positive and beneficial. They're good for our health, the actual eating of fresh, nutrient-rich food. They're good for our mental health, being outside, hands in the soil, building community together, working together. Not everybody has land to make a garden. So what we'll do, we create community gardens. Or you work within your neighborhood and you meet your neighbors and you have a garden together. There are endless possibilities for people to be able to do. And our society just wants to make it a little bit easier for everybody to do that.
We lived in Montreal. My wife and I lived in Montreal for 7 years. And we lived in a neighborhood with a lot of Italians and Greeks. And they had very productive gardens on a postage stamp, literally 15 feet by 15 feet. They had so many tomatoes, it looked like they could make tomato sauce just by smushing everything together in the front yard. It's astonishing how much can be grown in a small space. It can be grown in balconies. It can be grown in little, you know, beside pathways, all sorts of places that where food can be grown. I think that we're now in an age when if everybody does a little bit, we all make it through. Whereas if it's relying on, in the case of food, sources that are so far away that we have absolutely no control over their availability or the quality that comes in them, we're in big trouble. One of the issues that both of you face is the problem, if you want to call it, or the challenge of having families, small kids, lots of business involved, lots of activities involved with raising and educating your children yourselves, because, you know, there's education that goes on the formal system, but there's also the daily inculcating of values and you know, management of time and that kind of thing. How is that balance for each of you? Because you both share this kind of role. Serena, what's it like to try and juggle all these balls at the same time?
Well, the juggling aspect is difficult. However, I think Melanie and I, and probably everyone in this line of work, does this for the reason of our children. I mean, that is essentially why I'm doing this, is I am deeply concerned about our food system. And I am very concerned about my children's future as my, you know, and potentially grandchildren. I mean, there is so much evidence there that we need to change. That it's incredible. It's overwhelming. And like, there's really the impetus we need to, and like, you know, the reason I quit my other job and started doing this is because I think it's important. And it's imperative, actually. And doing it for my children, really.
And now every survey of children and their expectation of the future is showing this incredible upwelling of despair, because the children are not seeing the adults taking this seriously. When adults do take it seriously, when they do take planning for the future seriously, the mental state of their children and of the children around them dramatically improves. And there is abundant evidence that eco-anxiety is cured by action, not by medication, not by counseling, not by conversations, but by action. Melanie, your thoughts on this as we approach the end of the show?
Like Serena, I'm doing this for my children as well. I want to make sure that there's adequate food in our community where they live. I care about all children having adequate food as well, and every person, and seniors too. They often get kind of forgotten in this too. We live in very challenging times, and I really believe that food is a cornerstone of the action that we can all take to make huge impacts in all different levels, whether it be the environment, our mental health, community building. I think this is the one thing that we can really rally behind and make huge strides towards improvement in our future.
Yeah, and you know, food has always been a bridge, right? And I think that's how we're seeing it, is we're trying to build bridges between other organizations and people, so that you know, because we need everyone to participate in this fight against climate change.
Well, the metaphor of food is love, food is, you know, music to to people's ears, but it's so visceral. It affects your body as well as your mind. It at every level is a way to bring people together and also to sustain us. In every way, it sustains us, and when it's part of what we do on a daily basis, then we understand that, and then the values of a community start to level out and become centered around things like inclusion and collaboration, working together. I want to thank both of you for having been part of our final show of the season. Your contribution both on the show and elsewhere has been huge, and I think the community owes you both and the organization of a debt of gratitude for the work you're doing. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.